Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
So we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing to us the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns. I am Harvey Wasserman, back for another scintillating hour with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to be talking today about net neutrality and the corporate assault on the internet with the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, its five members contemplating the destruction of net neutrality. We're joined by Tim from freepress.net. Are you with us, Tim?
Hi, Harvey. How are you?
I'm great, man. How are you? So do me a favor and introduce yourself. I am not an expert on this. I have vented some fury with a piece co-authored with Bob Fitrakis at freepress.org. Bob, are you on with us? Okay, Bob's not yet joined us, but Tim, I know you're capable of handling a full hour on this topic. I'd like you to explain. First of all, I want you to introduce yourself. I always ask my guests to introduce themselves. Give us your full name and your title and what you do, please, because you are right at the cutting edge of this issue.
Sure, of course. Thanks for having me on your program today. Yes, my name is Timothy Carr. I am the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press, which is at freepress.net. And Free Press is a national, not-for-profit organization that fights for everyone's right to connect and communicate. And in 2014, often those battles are fought over access to all of the information that's on the internet, and it's an issue called net neutrality that a lot of your listeners might be familiar with that's being debated right now in Washington.
All right, so Tim, tell us the basics. First of all, tell us, define for us, if you would, what the is in front of the Federal Communications Commission and how it would affect net neutrality and the nature of the internet as we know it today.
Sure. The Federal Communications Commission is the federal agency that's charged with protecting the public interest in the media space. And increasingly, that means protecting the public interest online, on the internet. And one of the main issues before the agency, an issue that it has grappled with over the last 10 years, is an issue that's called net neutrality. Net neutrality is this idea, a lot of us take for granted, that whenever we go online, we can connect with anyone else that's online. We can use whatever website or service we choose. It's all a part of this open network. And I think people, you know, just understand that inherently. If you're on the internet, you know, you can just type up any URL and you can get there. And that idea, this open network, is actually pretty revolutionary because it has removed the gatekeeper from the media equation. In the history of communications, you've always had these dominant gatekeepers, whether they're radio or television stations that decide what sort of programming goes on, or newspapers, which decide, you know, what stories go on the first page and what stories don't get covered. The internet blew that all open. And what's happened over the last 10 years is that the most powerful companies that control internet access, companies like Comcast, AT&T and Verizon and Time Warner Cable.
Before you proceed, Tim,
yes.
Name all the providers of the internet, if you would. You got four there. Are there others?
It depends. And there are national. There's a handful of national providers that include Comcast, Time Warner Cable, AT&T, Verizon, Charter. I mean, the list is not very long of organizations that have services that go beyond a single region. But if you get local, you'll find that there are a few smaller options, local providers that provide services in a state or in a region, but there are only a small number of very dominant providers, and the biggest ones out there really are Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and Time Warner Cable.
What percentage of the internet users do these four providers supply?
They have services available in most all of the across most of the country. So I would say if you look at high speed internet service providers and you look at those four, you're looking at a good 75% of services. Now I don't have those numbers before me, but I have looked at this in the past, and that's a good approximation. They really do dominate the industry. And one thing that's important is that they don't often overlap. So you may be in a place like Chicago where Comcast is really the only dominant cable provider. So while, you know, you might think that Comcast and Charter Communications compete with one another, they actually have local monopolies. They don't overlap that much, which gives even fewer options for customers that are looking to get connected.
I think, are we joined by Bob Fitrakis? Bob, are you on yet? I guess not. Okay, so Tim, proceed then. These companies, my understanding, especially these four, have a huge financial interest in bifurcating the internet. And they have proposed, or, you know, allegedly Thomas Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC, has proposed, but obviously he's doing this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, obviously he's doing this on behalf of the major providers. He is proposing a change in internet regulation and how charges are done. Can you explain that to us?
Well, he was, yes, Chairman Wheeler is proposing new rules. And there's a bit of a history here, and you know, if you can bear with me for just a moment.
We've got a full hour.
You got a full hour. Well, I give you the whole history. So, as I said, the FCC has grappled with this issue. Like, how do we protect choice on the internet? That has been something that they've grappled with for years.
And
choice on the internet. This is really about your ability to choose where you want to go, what you want to say, whom you want to connect with, So the FCC was traditionally put in place by following the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to treat internet service providers as what are called common carriers. Common carriers are any communication service that deals with two-way communications, and the common carrier rule is that you cannot discriminate. You cannot – everything that comes across your pipeline – you have to move it to its destination without blocking or discriminating. And so a very good example for people would be like a telephone. If you pick up a telephone and you dial a number and you call, you know, the pizza joint that's down on the corner, your telephone company cannot say, oh, we have a special deal with Domino's Pizza. We're going to redirect that call from that local pizza joint to Domino's. They are common carriers, and the common carrier rule says you have to just move that information along. You can't discriminate. You can't block. So that was the understanding of how the internet was supposed to work until the last 10 years when, first under the Bush administration, they removed that common carrier rule. And with that rule out of place, there was a temptation by a lot of these phone and cable companies to start to discriminate, to redirect your internet connection from maybe you wanted to go to Google for search. Function, but maybe would rather have you search via their own tool to redirect your communications. And the FCC has for years been trying to get that rule back. So fast forward to 2014, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, an Obama appointee, has said, okay, I have the solution. I'm going to put forth a rule that will protect our choice on the internet. And unfortunately, the rule that he has put forward does the opposite. It allows these internet service providers to favor certain types of traffic and certain websites over others. So that is why this has become a fairly prominent issue in the news this year. There has been a massive outcry More than 1.4 million people have submitted comments to the FCC. 99% of those comments have said, you've got to stop this. You've got to protect net neutrality. So this chairman is now in a pickle. He has put this proposal out. It was resoundingly rejected by the public, and now he needs to figure out what he's going to do. Will he follow the public's advice and restore net neutrality protections, or will he, as someone who used to work for phone and cable companies, will he simply push through his rule and let them act as gatekeepers to content on the Internet?
Tim, let's review this now. Basically, you're saying that Tom Wheeler, he's a Democrat, right?
Tom Wheeler was appointed by Obama, and he's raised money for Obama's campaign, so I think that's fair to assume, yes.
Okay, that's fine. Now, the nature of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is that it has to be bipartisan. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are five commissioners that vote on the FCC, and there's always a majority that goes with the White House. So if there's a Democrat in the White House, you have three of those commissioners who are Democrats and two who are Republicans. And Wheeler is one of the Democratic commissioners.
And yet he is putting forward the most destructive regulation change in the history of the FCC. Is that correct? At least in terms of the Internet. Is that fair to say?
Sorry, Harvey, I missed that question. There was somebody calling in on another line. What was the question again?
Okay, Tom Wheeler, the Democrat, has put forward this change in the basic structure of the Internet. Is that correct?
He is putting forward a proposal that would re-engineer the Internet in very dramatic ways that would take away the sort of freedom of choice, free speech rights that Internet users have.
And isn't this something that Barack Obama promised not to do?
Barack Obama, yes. In 2007, then-candidate Barack Obama decided that he was going to make net neutrality a signature issue, and he made a number of speeches that said that he is an avid supporter of net neutrality. He said, and I'm quoting him, that he would take a backseat to no one in his support for net neutrality, and he also pledged to appoint, if he were elected, as the chair of the FCC, someone who held similar views. Now, as we know, Obama has been in office for 6 years, and he has had the opportunity to appoint two people to chair the FCC, and neither of them has fulfilled that pledge.
What happened to the previous one?
Chairman Julius Genachowski put forth what he thought was an open Internet rule. It was challenged in the courts by Verizon and a federal appeals court earlier this year in 2014 said that the rule didn't have legal standing and it was rejected. So his effort was a fairly flimsy effort at getting real net neutrality. And the reason that it failed was that he failed to do what we have been urging the FCC to do for almost 10 years now, is to reclassify Internet service providers as those common carriers, as a type of service that must move information without discriminating as to its content.
Okay, we're joined by my sidekick, Bob Fetrakis. Bob, you're on with us?
Yeah, I'm here, Harvey.
Okay, now Bob and I have co-authored a piece up at Columbus Free Press about net neutrality and the proposed changes. Bob, can you tell us a little bit about the civil liberties and free speech implications that Tim Carr here has been discussing for the changes in the Internet?
Well, you know, American media has been consolidated for long periods of time. Now, at one point, you had the Big Six, sometimes Big Seven. Sometimes it depends on how you count it. But clearly, if you allow discrimination over the Internet, then really there's been numerous attempts over the years for the commercial interests to want to divide up, told the internet, parcel out it as just another product. And of course, I think, Harvey, if you think about our site, freepress.org, there's been times, particularly in 2012, when our revelation that friends of Mitt Romney at, Bain Company and that people that had left there had bought up Hart Inner Civic, the third largest voting company in America with electronic voting machines, if that our site could have been discriminated against or not loaded as fast or ignored or kicked way down, we would have never been able to be one of the hottest political sites in the world. I mean, the beauty of net neutrality, and there's been essays on this recently, it's really ushered in the golden age, at least electronically, in terms of investigative reporting. And the best reporting at this period of time has really come from investigative journalists on the Internet, and I include you in that. And at times in the 2008 election, 2012 election, we were able also to break the story because we're not being blocked, we're not being slowed down. This story regarding the experimental patches that were put on computers illegally in Ohio and the lawsuit that revealed that. So I think there's staggering implications if you can block small but very good investigative sites like freepress.org and the many other out there, you know, Robert Perry site, Consortium News, which I consider to be just a brilliant investigative site.
And Tim Carr, this is Bob Fitrakis, publisher of the Columbus Free Press and freepress.org, and my co-author on a new article at freepress.org about this situation with net neutrality. Tim, is this overreacting?
No, no, this is not. These are not simply hypotheticals. In fact, if you look at the history of net neutrality violations, one of the most egregious occurred in 2005 when TELUS, which is the second largest internet service provider in Canada, blocked access to a pro-union website that was in a labor dispute with, guess who? TELUS. So there have been very real instances where internet service providers have used their gatekeeper power to block political content, and that is one of the most egregious examples.
All right. Now, Tim Carr, before we, and you're from also a very good investigative site, freepress.net, and of course there are many, many others, but I would have to say that the internet, the unfettered internet, has been the lifeblood of what's left of democracy in this country and, in fact, in this world. Tim, let's go back before we lose too much track of this, the politics of the Federal Communications Commission. Now, Commissioner Jenikowski tried to move, let me get, tell me if I'm wrong, he tried to move a piece of, I guess you'd say, regulation, not legislation, but regulation, that would apparently have guaranteed net neutrality, but which you say did not go far enough and was therefore bounced by the courts. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. He put together a very flimsy legal argument for protecting net neutrality. It didn't go far enough to reclassifying, to reversing a decision that was made by his predecessor, Michael Powell, who was under the Bush administration, to reclassify internet service providers as common carriers. That is what is really at the core of the debate here, is a legal definition. And I'm sorry, like, you know, these free speech issues can sometimes go down to these simple legal definitions. A legal definition which classifies companies like Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, Time Warner Cable, Charter as common carriers, as services that have to transport information without bias. They have fought that designation for more than a decade because they believe that the future of the media is the internet. I think that's something that all of us on this call would agree as well. But in their view, the future of their success as very powerful corporations is to become the gatekeepers of the internet, to shut down this open network that has fostered free speech and innovation for decades now. and become the companies that decide what kind of information gets to internet users around the world.
Okay, so let's put this in a larger context. I'm going to ask you both to describe the nature of the current proposal. But before we do that, I want to review what's happened with the media in this country. And Bob, as a political scientist and a historian, can you fill us in on the history of the fairness doctrine, and then the 1990, which was overturned by the Reagan administration, and then the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and tell us how that's the loss of those two protections has affected media access and media reporting in this country?
Well, if you go back even farther, Harvey, I think part of the problem, you basically are trading the telegraph around 1844. Within 4 years, 1848, you get the AP, right, and Associated Press, the largest press conglomerate that really dominated a lot of American news well into when I was doing college radio back in the 70s with Rip and Reed. It was just, you know, you were going to get your news from the AP. But a variety of things that have happened over time. In a place like Columbus, where you have about 31 radio stations, you used to have, 12 to 15 different news directors. And really what you were dealing with is that all of them, if you listen to the Delaware station, which was a farm station, you got a different perspective and a marketplace idea. And a lot of that began to break down with the Telecommunication Act. In the mid-90s, when you opened ownership up, instead of being limited to an AM-FM station, you began to, buy half a dozen on each side of the dial. But even prior to that, as you've mentioned, during the Reagan years, you had both the Fairness Doctrine and you had the Equal Time Provision, right? So responsible parties, if someone was running op-ed, which something like Fox News does day and night, a responsible party could go on and offer a different perspective under the Fairness Doctrine. And candidates under Equal Time Provision, if the large broadcast entities were out there giving all the broadcast time to one candidate who they favored because he favored their interests, the other candidate could demand equal time. So the elimination of those things, particularly the equal time provision, and really the narrowing of who controlled the media with not only the rise of Clear Channel, but Disney, with 270 or so stations, and CBS and others, that were these large, not only broadcast entities, but media monopolies as well, really narrowed the perspective. So often you'd be listening to the dial six different channels, and really you're getting all the same programming.
So in 1927 or so, when radio was first coming in, the Congress, which was a Republican Congress, understood that with radio and the monopolization of radio, which was clearly going to be a very powerful medium, by large corporations, that you needed some kind of balance. And so in 1927, I believe, they put in the Fairness Doctrine, which required owners of radio stations to provide equal time for an opposing point of view. Is that correct, Bob?
Well, yeah, you've got that as the general thrust. I mean, but even more important, the people that weighed in on that debate. I mean, Herbert Hoover, the president, was weighing in after he was elected in 28. John Dewey, wrote some of the most perceptive stuff on the use of that medium, allowing it to become over-commercialized, and really argued for the intellectual edification of the masses through the media. But it was a very intense and brilliant public policy debate that you really don't see in the country anymore, even though to some extent the commercialization of that. And I think Dewey worried tremendously about that and saw the direction it was likely to go.
And then in addition to the Fairness Doctrine, and when there were restrictions on ownership of media outlets. Tim Carr, are you familiar with this kind of legislation?
Sure. And what it meant? History of broadcast consolidation is has been fairly well researched by quite a few people. We have these processes with these types of innovations. I mean, at one time, radio was considered this amazing technological innovation, and it was, and it was used by a great diversity of people, and it was through this process of re-regulation of the industry that allowed for consolidation to occur, and power over radio, control of radio spectrum, fell into the hands of a very few number of companies. And the same thing happened with television. And the same thing happened with cable television. And we're now in a cycle, I think, with the Internet, where very powerful interests have realized how important, how revolutionary this medium is, if only they can gain control of it. And I think the battle to destroy net neutrality is a part of that history. It is an effort by the new titans of the media, big cable and phone companies, to control the future of communications.
And this was overturned now in 1996. Is that right, Bob? The ability of the government to regulate who owns how many stations in a locale, that was done in by Clinton and Gore in 1996, correct?
Well, I think Tim can correct me, but I think there were at a certain point you could own 6 a.m. or 6 of the FM, and I remember also Michael Powell recommending there be virtually no restriction on ownership whatsoever. But what also I see is someone who worked in the industry, in the 1980s, a lot of the campuses where I grew up at Grand Valley University in Michigan, there were a lot of campus radios, and a lot of them were shut down as well by or converted over to different, like, public radio signals, ending the student voice that had grown out of the 1960s. So you had a situation, and here in Columbus, Harvey, as you well know, during the cable battle, we got public access. I worked with that in Detroit as well as in Columbus. But the city has used various rulings to shut down all public access TV and just put the cable franchise fee money that we pay for into their general budget. Virtually all the cities had provided public access TV. So we live in the 15th largest city in America, and we have no public access TV as well.
Tim, do you follow what's happening to public access TV in your FreePress.net operations?
Oh, sure. You know, the obligations that cable companies make through local franchise agreements to provide for local public access have been, you know, whittled down to next to nothing. And so that, you know, that's something that we've lost over the years, is that idea of a contract between cable providers and the communities that they are supposed to serve. So you do see, you know, in cities throughout the country, this loss of community access cable television stations because the cable industry sees so much value in controlling all of those channels. And so that has been, that's a part of the problem. I mean, now we have cable companies not only providing you with cable television access, but they're also in the business of providing you with high-speed internet services. So when
all
we
right.
see a merger like a Comcast, which is first merged with NBC Universal and now is as a proposed merger with Time Warner Cable, and when you see that kind of consolidation happening, it should worry you on a number of fronts.
Listen, we're going to take a short break now. We'll be back after 3 minutes. We're talking with Bob Fitrakis and Tim Carr about the Internet and net neutrality and control of the media. You're going to hear Dana Lyons singing the Soartopia Rocky Top version. And we'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran. to Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me.
Indeed, lots of forests. Okay, lots of forests for the bears. That's my buddy Dana Lyons of Solartopia, Rocky Top version. Dana, of course, is the genius behind Cows with Guns, the anthem of the vegetarian movement. We're talking to two great commentators on the state of our media in this country, Bob Fitrakis of freepress.org and Tim Carr of freepress.net. And what we've gotten through in the first half hour, among other things, is a discussion of what has happened to control of the electronic media, which is focused, of course, entirely now in the hands of several, not too many, but several large corporations. There was the Fairness Doctrine from 1927, which required owners of radio stations to put out alternative points of view once they use their power on the radio to express their own point of view. And the restrictions that disappeared under Ronald Reagan. And then the restrictions on ownership of large media outlets that disappeared with the 1996 Telecommunications Act put forward by Bill Clinton and Al Gore. So now we were left in the 1990s with a situation where the traditional electronic media, radio and TV, were completely dominated by several major corporations. In comes the Internet, and the Internet has been in somewhat of a state of nature, a state of grace, since that time. Tim, can you describe for us, please, the state of the Internet and how it's been protected to date to give us the kind of access, open access, that we've had?
Sure, and it's a really interesting story, because the Internet was really created by engineers and academics. Most of them were working on Defense Department contract to build this kind of decentralized network that could survive a nuclear attack and share information and archive information. And so what these network engineers designed is something called the end-to-end network. It's a network where there is all of the intelligence exists at the ends of the network, and the center of the network just moves information from edge to edge. That was an engineering principle, but it was also, as the network developed, became very clear to a lot of people that it was a pretty radical political idea. If you take the gatekeeper, if you take the center, out of the media equation, you have created an information network, communications network, where all of the power to choose, resides at the edges with Internet users and not at the center with the gatekeepers, who in traditional media have been a lot of these large companies who determined, you know, what content got seen and what didn't. And so that has evolved over the years to create this massive network where you see these kind of really amazing stories about, kids in their dorm room who come up with a new website that becomes the next Google, or somebody's working out of their garage that creates, you know, the next eBay. And this decentralized edge-to-edge network has also been very helpful for political causes, because you have, for example, an organization like Move On that was started by a husband and wife in the Bay Area who had an idea, started an email list that now numbers more than 8 million people and has a lot of political power in getting people out to vote and supporting candidates. So this network became politically powerful. It became economically powerful for underdogs, and that is what's under threat today, is this idea of trying again to put the genie back in the bottle for these very powerful media companies to say, well, we don't really like that our gatekeeper status has been taken away. How do we get it back? How do we turn the internet upside down, take this decentralized network and centralize it again with our companies deciding what information gets to move and what information doesn't. So we're in that situation right now, and it's become a legal argument in Washington around this issue of net neutrality. It's like, how do we put forth net neutrality protections to protect this decentralized network? That is what a lot of public interest groups are fighting for at the FCC right now, and we face a very formidable foe in phone and cable companies that have spent over the last decade more than $100 million to hire lobbyists on campaign contributions, on PR firms and think tanks to oppose this idea of net neutrality and try to fundamentally change this open network that has become such a powerful force for many.
Well, let me make this clear. Who paid for the development of the internet?
Well, initially it was government contracts through DARPA, which is Defense Department, that created the basic design of the network.
So the taxpayer funded the beginnings of the internet. Is that correct?
That's correct. But you know, it became global. So the internet is not a single network. It is a network of interconnected networks. Some were built by private entities, others were built by public entities. It's really amorphous in that sense. But originally, the original design was paid for by taxpayers, and the money was spent via Defense Department contracts.
Bob, you want to add to that? Bob Fetrakis of FreePress.org.
No, but I would point out how important the internet has become. The Columbus Free Press, FreePress.org, was one of the first dozen alternative papers that went online, and partly because we lost a lot of the subscription reader wars among all these alternative papers that used to exist in this country through the Alternative News Association. The Guardian, which was very progressive, you and I wrote for Harvey, that went under in the mid-90s, the Free Press, when we ceased publication, we were able to survive and report news and, in fact, be probably at the height of our public influence only because of the Internet. I remember the Columbus Live has been bought up by the Columbus Dispatch, the Wolf family, which holds $1 billion in assets and controls 93% of the print media in Central Ohio. They also, of course, bought up the other paper. And it's only because of the Internet we were able to come back out in print. It's because of our popularity in the Internet we came back out as a weekly and now still exist as a monthly. So it really was a forum that saved alternative reporting in the Buckeye State, in the great swing state, in the capital city. Remember, all these great alternative newspapers have all pretty much vanished or been bought up by corporate networks.
Right, but they've been replaced now online on the left by places like Common Dreams, Alternet, Counterpunch, and so on. So, Tim, as someone who spends his days working on this, give us what you feel is the role of the Internet in preserving democracy.
Well, it plays a very central role because the Internet has made the First Amendment a living document for millions and millions of people. The First Amendment was meant to protect free speech, but you know, as the saying goes, it's great for those who can own the press, but not so much for those of us who want to speak via other means. And the Internet has made access to the medium, access to the press, affordable to hundreds of millions of people. And if you go globally, more than a billion people now go online. So
a billion people go online?
More than a billion people have access to the Internet, whether they're using it via wired or wireless devices. And we haven't seen that scale
of free speech at any time in our history. It is unprecedented. The problem that we're facing right now is that that speech is happening via private networks, whether you're talking about Facebook, whether you're talking about Twitter, whether you're talking about websites, whether you're talking about these large network providers. Those are privately owned companies that give people the false sense of security that their speech is protected. But as we've learned from incidents on Facebook and Twitter, that they actually have hidden within their terms and conditions. When you sign up for those social networks or when you sign up to use any of those web services, they have you sign on to an agreement, and hidden deep within those terms and conditions is the rights that these privately owned entities have to censor you. And that's not something that we can appeal to the First Amendment for protection. The First Amendment prevents governments from censoring, but it doesn't necessarily prevent private networks from censoring. Well, the protection that we have in place for free speech over private networks is, again, this idea of common carriage. It's where these private networks have to obey under a rule where they act as indiscriminate transporters of information. So that is the debate that we're having right now in this era of like broad, massive-scale free speech, or massive-scale speech, I should say. How do we protect our freedom of expression when people are using private networks to communicate?
Well, Tim Carr of FreePress.net, what is the argument that the other side is using? What are the corporations saying about why the internet should be bifurcated? What they want to do essentially is have two tiers of access. Correct me if I'm wrong. Two tiers of access, and you pay for the higher tier. And so people who have access to the higher tier by paying more money get better access than those on the lower tier. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, we already have a situation that's kind of similar to that, but it's we are as internet users, we can decide what level of service we want to have. Some of us may have DSL connections. Some of us may pay for cable or faster connections if we have those options in our marketplace. So that's a basic contract that we have with our internet service provider. Say, I will pay you, you know, $40, $50, $60, whatever amount per month for this speed of service. But after we pay for that service, the internet service provider is simply supposed to get out of our way. Once we go online, we can go wherever we want. Now, they want to put a second agreement in place where not only where you pay for a certain speed of service, which we're already doing, but the websites that are out there, big websites like Netflix, for example, that stream movies, will also have to pay them in order to reach their customers. And so they're creating this kind of prioritization that allows very wealthy and powerful companies to get a dominant position on the network while the rest of us are relegated to slower tiers of service. So it is this kind of situation where the level playing field, this decentralized network that has been central to the growth of the internet, is now being upended in a way that allows ISPs to give powerful companies, including themselves, priority on the internet, making their services the only ones that you can use at the expense of all this kind of innovation and upstart ingenuity that has been the trademark of the network since its inception.
So what are the free speech implications, Bob Fetrakis, of this kind of bifurcation of the internet?
Well, I think if you slow the loading and slow the traffic and you favor essentially what we regard as the freepress.org as a corporate plutocracy, I mean, these massive entities, which have been well documented at freepress.net, I just got done teaching a politics and media class today and going over the charts you'll find at freepress.net about these just completely integrated media giant. If they are giving themselves an advantage and there's an advantage under law for them, it's how do you compete? I mean, if the freepress.org is relegated and is loading slower, or is coming up much slower than others, I mean, we live in an era of instant information. It seems like the perfect way to move away from serious content to, again, the weapons of mass distraction.
Tim Carr, what would the Bob? Thank you for that. Tim Carr of FreePress.net. What, tell us the implications for freedom of speech and of the press if this proposal to bifurcate the internet goes through.
Well, I think it would be pretty grave because we're really taking this revolutionary network that has allowed so many people to speak, and we're putting gatekeepers in place. And you know, during the legal arguments in advance of this FCC process, the Verizon put its lawyers forward at the Federal Appeals Court, and they basically said, and I'm quoting this, it gets pretty Orwellian here, but they basically said that the First Amendment protects their ability as a network provider to censor, in their words, edit all internet content. And so the argument that they are putting forward, internet service providers, is that the First Amendment in this instance does not protect internet users, but it should protect those corporate persons known as Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast in their ability, and this is where it gets Orwellian, to edit and censor internet content. So this argument has gotten twisted to such a degree by them that they are looking at this as a free speech issue for them at the expense of the millions, tens of millions of people who are now using the internet to communicate. So we're basically handing the ability to censor, if we lose net neutrality, to these very powerful phone and cable companies that do control increasingly the future of all communications.
Shocking. And so, and of course, these internet service providers did not invent the internet, and they did not develop it as an organ they just bought in at some point. Is that correct?
And they don't even own the internet today. They provide what's called the last mile connection to their customers. And those are the lines that they string into your house and down your street, but they don't control the whole network, although they're acting as if they do.
Would it be possible, if this passed, to establish an internet service provider that would not be bifurcated?
It's possible, although we're a long way from there. There have been some signs of hope. Municipalities, there have been some great examples. Chattanooga, Tennessee, for example, have built their own fiber-to-the-home networks. Some of them have built Wi-Fi mesh networks that offer another option than your local cable giant. There have been efforts by the cable companies and the phone companies to pass state-level legislation. They've succeeded in 20 states that prohibit communities from building their own municipal broadband options.
So the large corporations have passed laws to prohibit communities from building ISP
networks? In the United
networks?
States, they've used their lobbying power to introduce state-level laws that ban municipalities from building their own broadband networks and serving their citizens.
Unbelievable.
It's sort of akin to having, you know, like Random House pass a law that prohibits cities from having public libraries.
Unbelievable. We're talking with Tim Carr of FreePress.net, Bob Fitrakis of FreePress.org about the internet. Tim, you're close to this in Washington. Tell us what the situation is, please, and what people can do to prevent this destruction of the internet and the free access to it.
Well, the good news is that people have actually spoken out about net neutrality. There's a proceeding at the FCC there where they have invited public comments to comment on the FCC chairman's proposal. And since that docket opened, nearly 1.4 million people have commented. The Sunlight Foundation, which is a very good open data transparency organization, went in and analyzed those millions of comments and found that 99% of public comments are in support of strong net neutrality. So there has been this uprising at the FCC where people have been commenting. People are still people can still comment there. The comment process doesn't close until September 15th.
early next week. You go to the FCC.gov, and you can comment directly through their website, or you can go to freepress.net, where we have some simple tools that allow you to put your comments into the FCC.
And, Tim, what is the breakdown of the vote? When is the vote going to happen?
Well, they're going to look at all of these comments that have come in, and I suspect there will be many, many more in the week to come. And then they will make a decision. Since this is a very politically sensitive decision, I'm fairly confident that the FCC won't vote on it until after the midterm elections. So it could happen in late November or December, or even be delayed until next year.
And Bob Fitrakis, would you guess that if they vote against net neutrality, it'll be announced on a Friday afternoon?
No doubt, probably on a major holiday weekend.
Yeah, so the question then is, Tim and Bob, if you know the answer, there's five commissioners on the FCC. The Democratic chair, obviously, is poised to vote to destroy net neutrality. Is that correct?
His current proposal would do that, yes.
And then we have two Democrats and two Republicans. And how does that appear to shake down?
Well, the politics get pretty weird. The two Republicans will not vote with the Democratic chairman, even though his position is in support of cable and phone companies. They simply won't vote. As you've probably noticed, Republicans won't vote with Democrats on any matter. So the real power to persuade the chairman rests in the hands of the two remaining Democratic commissioners, Mignon Clyburn and Jessica Rosenworcel, who can convince the chairman that if they support reclassification, if they support common carriage, if he supports common carriage, he'll have a majority vote, and we can actually establish lasting net neutrality protections. Now, we're a long way from that, but there still is hope.
And Bob Fitrakis, as an attorney, would you envision, if the FCC overturns net neutrality, will there be a remedy in the courts?
Well, I don't know if there'll be a remedy in the courts, but I think there'll be obviously the legal challenges that'll go forward. I'd like to also hope that there would be a lot of real creative solutions from the tech community, including many people that are committed to the actual marketplace of ideas. I mean, the problem with the gatekeepers that Tim's been talking about is the Internet was actually working as a marketplace of ideas, and I think there's so many people that are committed to it across the political spectrum that I think you'll begin to see some forms of rebellion, and I hope some new sort of ways, creative ways and innovations in the tech world to make sure that the gatekeepers, you know, the new plutocracy, information plutocracy, can't succeed.
Well, Tim, from FreePress.net, what guerrilla alternatives would remain to the public should this go the wrong way?
Well, I think we can continue to advocate on behalf of local communities building their broadband networks to try to overthrow some of the state-level laws that prevent that from happening. Communities and, you know, the technology is becoming more and more accessible. There are a lot of groups that are working on local self-reliant solutions to Internet access. You can support municipal broadband networks. You can support Wi-Fi networks at the local level that will help people get online without having to depend upon these very large phone and cable companies.
All right. Thank you so much. You guys have been very informative. Bob Fitrakis of FreePress.org. Tim Kerr of FreePress.net. Tim, want to give us your access?
Sure. You can reach me. You can follow me on Twitter at Tim Carr, but if you want to engage on this issue, go to FreePress.net and take action.
And Bob Fitrakis at FreePress.org. You and I have a piece up there. And this has been a disturbing but important informational session here on the future of free speech and what's left of it on the Internet. And by the way, PRN, of course, is an Internet-based provider. Thank you so much to the staff in New York for this program. We will be back next week at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. And I got to say that getting to Solartopia really depends on a free and open Internet. And that's what we got to preserve. Thank you both for being with us, and we'll see you next week at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
When the sun shone down. on the Garden of Eden.